You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Martin Davies from Texas Public Radio, and I wrote a comic book. The comic book is called San Antonio Secret History. San Antonio is celebrating its tricentennial in 2018. You know, the Alamo, that's a big thing, hemisphere, all sorts of great stuff. But I wanted to look at other things that have happened here. I've been a reporter, I grew up here, and I have come across a lot of stories that I thought more people should know about. Woodlawn Pool, I grew up in that area, spent a lot of time there as a kid, as a teenager, became a lifeguard. I didn't know an important story that had taken place there. It was in June of 1957. Six African-American children jumped in the pool. You would think that would be nothing, but this is the age of Jim Crow, and this was a whites-only pool at the time. The city freaked out. The city shut down all of the city pools, and the city passed an emergency ordinance segregating the pools. At the time, it was just the Jim Crow was an unofficial understanding, and now they had to codify it into law. That happened on Juneteenth. It's like, wow, this is an important remnant of Jim Crow racism right here, and I knew nothing about it. What happened to that history? Why was it erased? We need to know that. We need to remember that. That needs to be part of our conscious understanding of where we are. I had no idea what the reaction was going to be. I was kind of like, oh, I'm going to make this comic book and we'll put it out there and see if anyone pays attention to it. The reaction has been very enthusiastic support for it. People appreciate the stories. I charge $5 a copy, so it's not going to make any money. You're losing money on it. It's really, I just wanted to make this available. I want people to get hold of these copies, read them, and give them to someone else. So it's available in bookstores in San Antonio, particularly at the Twig, and we're making it available at Texas Public Radio, and it's now available on Amazon.com. This has been David Martin Davies with Texas Public Radio talking about my comic, San Antonio Secret History, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
This is the San Antonio Tricentennial Minute from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. September 6, 1861, Bob Augustine was arrested for disorderly conduct. Augustine rode into town from Goliad to join Sibley's Brigade, an ill-fated Confederacy plan organized in San Antonio to invade the New Mexico Territory. Augustine's crime was wrecking the chili stands of Main Plaza. 2 days later, he was released from jail, but he was then taken by a mob. They brought him to the southeast corner of Military Plaza to the hanging tree named La Ley de Mondragon. The lynch mob declared by unanimous consent that Augustine was a bad man.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, San Antonio at its tricentennial, what global and local forces defined and shaped the city at its founding and still today. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. 300 years ago, San Antonio was a military outpost beyond what was known. It was put in a place called the New World, a place that was far away, unexplored, and uncertain. It was founded and settled to prove to the Old World that this land belonged to Spain. And over the next three centuries, the city would change hands and flags multiple times, with the fate of Texas hanging in the balance. Today, San Antonio is the seventh largest city in the nation and one of the fastest growing cities in America, and it continues fighting some of the same old battles over water, political power, poverty, and race. Char Miller writes about it in his new book, San Antonio, A Tricentennial History.
San Antonio, distant though it was also a place of great conflict, horrendous conflict, actually, up through the 19th century. And so it was at once a frontier space, and that was problematic unto itself, but also a place over which despite the fact that it was off the map. People fought over in pitched battles in various ways, and the Alamo is just one of many of those battles and conflicts. And I think, you know, it may have been on another zone, but it turns out that human beings were really interested in that zone. And I would add a third or maybe fourth character to the story, which was the land itself. The land as a as an actor in the way in which human beings dealt with it, the water flows that were essential to survival there from the Payaya forward in time, and managing those resources or controlling them was also part of why people were fighting over this tiny little town far removed from the Spanish Empire and right in the path of the Lipan Apache and the Comanche and others.
But as you talked about San Antonio being an outpost for the Spaniards as they wanted to preserve the map, you know, they had to prove to the Pope in Europe that they were definitely doing something with this land and they could claim it as their own. And so originally San Antonio was a military outpost. San Antonio calls itself Military City, USA. It has trademarked that expression. Many people, when we talk about, hey, San Antonio Military City, USA, they think about the military as it is today, but actually it goes to the very beginnings.
The very beginnings, and it, you know, it's beautifully demonstrated in the first moment when the first entrada, the first expedition shows up in the city in which they're bristling with arms. And they're seeing this as a place not only to pacify the people who were here, but also to display weaponry, which is a way of showing that you have the capacity to do violence on others, and you will use that violence to control it. I mean, the irony for me, and it's not much of an irony, it's really this beautiful through line of the 300 years in which the city claims as its tricentennial, is that the military really built the city. It was the first to figure out why it should be built there, and it still remains this powerful force in shaping the life ways of the community. And although that has diminished after the BRAC Commission, you know, started diminishing the military's presence, but we still occupy the land and utilize those now closed bases in new ways, but those are old bases, right? So we're literally living on top of the world that the military built for us.
And moving forward after, you know, creation of the Presidio and the fighting for the settlement of San Antonio, it continued to be a battleground for the creation of Texas.
Yes, yes. And I think that's a story that rightly deserves a central place, although maybe not as centralized as we often do it. But I think the catalyst of a city that brought the Spanish to fight it, that brought the Mexicans to fight for it, that brought the Republican forces to fight in opposition to those other entities, is an extraordinary story. It's very rare, and I think it's Frank de la Teja, among others, who has argued that San Antonio may be the most fought over townscape, landscape in what is now the United States. And that really struck me as I was thinking about it. And then suddenly I could start to see what they were talking about and sort of crafted parts of the book to sort of reflect that. And even, you know, if we think about World War I, which we think is over there in Europe, San Antonio was deeply involved in that war, as much as it would be with World War II, as an equally in the Korean and Vietnam conflicts. And then the third thing, and it's really crucial, is it wasn't just about training military personnel. It was the tens of thousands of civilian defense workers who went onto those bases starting in World War I and then really accelerated World War II through the conflicts in Korea and Vietnam, and whose lives were fundamentally changed by it. One way to think about this, The military produced San Antonio's middle class.
This is the San Antonio Tricentennial Minute from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. November 9, 1859, a caravan of camels is led down the middle of Commerce Street in San Antonio to take its place in one of the strangest experiments by the U.S. military. The vast waterless land of the Southwest was a puzzle for the Army that Secretary of War Jefferson Davis figured could be solved with camels. The desert pack animals were shipped to Texas and then marched to San Antonio, where they were led to San Pedro Springs to camp. The Camel Corps outperformed mules in every category, but they weren't able to traverse the prejudice against the animal by military commanders.
I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome to Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. The city of San Antonio is hosting its tricentennial in 2018, and the celebrations have a soundtrack. The city commissioned local composer Federico Chavez Blanco to write music for various events, including a major orchestral and theatrical work to be revealed in the near future. We spoke to Chavez Blanco about the tricentennial commission.
Well, I've been a music provider, an artist for the city for many years. I was commissioned earlier to compose another ballet for the American for the Arts Convention. And I started chatting around, having a personal signature, musical signature, and then we started talking about the diversity as far as musical genres in San Antonio. And that's when the idea came, and the Department for Arts and Culture took me by the hand with the project. It's not a collection of 30-something tracks, but it's the sequence of colors, rhythms, and musical signatures. We've been trying to cover all the bases. We did it very well to fulfill all the requests as far as genre, styles, cultures.
And listening to some of the samples of the music you composed for the tricentennial, there is a lot of Mexican influence, a little bit of mariachi. The instrumentation has quite a bit of trumpet to it. What did you look to as far as the inspiration for the music that you were writing for the tricentennial? Were you looking for primarily a Hispanic tinge to the music?
Well, we live in a city that is Hispanic in a high percentage. When you mention San Antonio to someone, that's the first memory they have, the river, the mariachi music. So what we wanted was to balance those representations of the art, the classical stuff, the pop stuff. We have a very, very, very well-established pop community. We've been named Texas music-friendly city very recently due to a very hard labor from the Film Commission and Music Commission also. It's putting us in the spot in Texas music because we have a strong community. So what we wanted to do, the commercial representation, this music is intended to work as a music bed in all the events.
There's a work that you did recently called Cenicienta, had to do with mariachis, had to do with quinceañeras. Could you tell us a little bit more about that production? Because it garnered you quite a bit of fame here in San Antonio.
Oh, thank you. It's a musical that portrays one of the most beautiful Hispanic traditions. So you can visit Philippines and you can go to Argentina and they'll have their quinceañera a representation where all the family gets together to celebrate the coming of age of a teenager girl.
List? Royal court? Get food? Dresses? And boys? I can't wait to see what they'll pick out. It should be my quinceañera too.
And I was approached by a former San Antonio Independent School District music teacher, Pam Redman. She realized that when it came to the UIL musicals or the drama theater or the drama companies at the schools, they were only working with the standards, Oklahoma's, West Side Stories, but there was nothing that connected to their own tradition, their own language, their own race. She found that the quinceañeras where all the family gets together. You know, you bring the tías, the tíos, the abuelitos, the friends, the cousins. The work is just celebrate that tradition with mariachi music, and it's written in a manner, in a Greek style, that sometimes the mariachi is the narrator, sometimes the mariachi is a main part in the musical, and sometimes it's just the background music. It's intended to give you just a flavor of what's our tradition. And the funny thing is, when I started reading the book, I connected with every single character there because I know someone like this. This is like my cousin. This, you have everybody well represented there.
Federico Chavez Blanco is a native of Mexico and a San Antonio resident who has experience writing for television and film. He's recently been commissioned to compose the music for this year's San Antonio Tricentennial Celebrations. He composed the musical Cenicienta, a quinceañera with a taste of Cinderella, a mariachi tribute to a Hispanic family tradition. His music can also be heard on telenovelas such as Azul Tequila and Señora, and on a number of films and documentaries.
This is a San Antonio Tricentennial Minute from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. October 11, 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court hears the case Espinosa versus Ferra, which asked if refusing to hire someone who is a legal resident alien but is not a U.S. citizen is a violation of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. San Antonio resident and citizen of Mexico Cecilia Espinosa brought the case after she was refused employment by Ferra Manufacturing because she was not a citizen. The Supreme Court ruled 8-1 in favor of Ferra Manufacturing. It held that employment discrimination against non-citizens is allowed, even if they have legal work status.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. As San Antonio celebrates the tricentennial, are we telling the entirety of the city's story? Is enough attention being paid to the contributions of all the groups that helped build this city? San Antonio's African-American history is rich, deep, and complex. There were standout leaders in the Black community that played major roles in the city. The Reverend Claude Black, Ella Austin, Armeticia Bowden, Charles Bellinger, just to name a few. Who else should we be talking about today? How do we make sure that the city's Black heritage is remembered with respect and accuracy? Give us a call. We want to hear your story. The number is 210-614-8980. And do you have stories that you want to share about the African-American experience in San Antonio? 210-614-8980. And you can email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet us at @tprsource. We're joined by Kerry Lattimore. He is associate professor and the chair of the history department at Trinity University. And Mario Salas, he's a civil rights advocate and former city council member and a professor of the African-American studies department at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Welcome to The Source, all of you.
Thank you. It's great to have you here. Thank you.
So let me go to you, Mario Salas. How are we doing on this task of telling all the history of San Antonio?
Well, when I was appointed by the county, there was some concern by County Commissioner Tommy Calvert Jr. About the Black story not being told. And so he appointed me And I was readily wanting to take on that fight. And for a while under the old leadership, it was very difficult. But since we've had the city with Mr. Contreras take over, we've made some progress. So we've got still some way to go, but at least we've kind of broken through the whole notion of there is no black history in San Antonio. And you will hear people say that from time to time. So I was more than happy to try and remedy that situation by providing the expertise that I have.
Okay, we're going to talk about some of the forces that have to be dealt with and realize why this is, you put it, a fight to tell this story. And this idea, this canard that there is no black history in San Antonio. And this is natural. You know, we look back, I mean, going through old newspapers, looking at history books, and typically it's going to tell the story of the establishment and the stories of the power people, people who controlled the money, and typically the people who were not part of that are overlooked in the telling of the story. And so that's the struggle in order to bring that to the fore today, now that we have a better awareness of that there was an entire community with a history and a story to be told. And Carrie Lattimore at Trinity University, can you talk about that?
I mean, I think that one thing that when we look at San Antonio, it's a hard city to kind of characterize, right? It's Southern, but it's also Western. And because of those two, I think sometimes it doesn't have the same kinds of underpinnings as, say, a city like Atlanta or a city like Charlotte or Richmond. But on the other end, it's got this Western flavor. And so I think one of the reasons why it kind of gets left out is because when we see things that were happening in Birmingham or other cities, we see it happen less here. And I think it's also a population situation. The population of San Antonio by percentage has kind of gone, the black population has gone down since 1872 currently. And so I think there are a lot of different things happening. So I think sometimes when we look at the African American experience, we often only characterize it by the big things that were happening, whether it be Selma and other things. And because they happen on a smaller scale here, I think sometimes we think that it didn't happen. But if you look beneath the surface, it is happening, and it did happen. And I think history is written by the winners, but I think it's kind of hard to look at what's happening in San Antonio. I just think it's a hard city to characterize.
Hard city
as a person that doesn't come from here.
Yeah, but okay, so what, when I'm looking at the tricentennial, and we're trying to do an examination of how we arrived at the city that we have today, and that includes many of our self-constructs of like, what do we think about when we think about San Antonio? And when we do that, we want to think about the city in a positive light, in a progressive light, and there's plenty of progressive achievements to celebrate, but also we did have a lot of terrible things that needed to be acknowledged, that, you know, this was a city of Jim Crow, and this also was a city that was part of the South and part of secession, although San Antonio did, San Antonians did reject secession when we had the referendum on that at that time. So, Mario Salas, this, tell me more about when you want to talk about San Antonio's African-American history, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I always like to start off with the understanding that at one point, when the Spanish were in control of the area, and we're talking 1600s, and you could go back further to 1500s, but in 1600s, you're talking about the Spanish having a system that they call the Casta system, in which skin color was the rule from which to place people in different social strata. And as a result of this system, there was created, for any number of reasons, a separation of what was considered white versus what was considered non-white.
It was a caste system.
Yeah, the caste system. And from the evidence I've gathered, I think it's fair to make the assumption that the San Antonio River was perhaps the first line of segregation, meaning that whites, there was no north and south side of town. There was only east and west of the river. And so the river being the west side of the river being for whites, the east side of the river being for blacks. Now, this may have been established through the Casta system long before the Canary Islanders and may have been reinforced by the Canary Islanders. But I do know that some of the original black inhabitants came from Mexico. There was a heavy trade route between the city of Veracruz and San Antonio, as evidenced by Father Morphy, who did a lot of research in his memoirs and travel diaries. And if you look at the population of Veracruz, Mexico at that time, it was heavily inhabited by Angolan slaves and Angolan freemen, probably one of the heaviest populations in Mexico of black people who had been imported either through Havana via Africa or directly from Africa into the Mexican coast. So when I look at the east side, the home of African Americans in the present sense, we're talking about a long, long history of the east side being a place where blacks had to go as a result of this system of segregation.
And when you say a long history of that, I mean basically from the city's inception, that according to your research, you're saying that that was part of the way that the city evolved and grew up that way. And that's kind of, and we look back, why is the east side today where we see a large percentage, but also of African Americans, but throughout the San Antonio's history, there were other pockets of African Americans that were on the west side. I know off Zarzamora, mm-hmm. near Little Flower, there was a big a neighborhood. And so it's, and then no more. You know what happened?
Yeah, and that northern enclave of African Americans was probably the far most western stretches of an area called Newcombville, and Newcombville obviously established, and there is some evidence to suggest it was named after James Newcomb, one of the founders of the Express. I think it was called Alamo Express or whatever it was.
Right, the Alamo Express.
Yeah, and Newcomb was a Unionist who was in control in one degree or another of the black vote, because, of course, when the Confederates lose the Civil War, Newcomb becomes a political boss himself and forms a relationship with another political boss, the black guy who came before Charles sure. Bellinger, which was Lafayette Walker.
We'll talk about all that, but Newcomb, of course, was driven out of San Antonio by the Knights of the Golden Circle. They set up a noose for him in front of the Alamo. They were going to lynch him, and he rode down Commerce Street with his shotgun, saying, "Catch me if you can." We'll talk more about him when the source continues. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We'll be back.
This is the San Antonio Tricentennial Minute from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. October 23, 1960, San Antonio was gaga for John Wayne and his movie The Alamo. The Alamo City staged a three-day celebration for the Duke, including a 20,000-person square dance and a 30-foot cake in the shape of the Alamo that Wayne carved up with a Bowie knife, all leading to the world premiere of the film at the Woodlawn Theater. The Alamo epic was Wayne's personal dream and ambition. He was the producer and director and the star with the role of Davy Crockett. Wayne said he wanted the movie to inspire Americans during the Cold War era.